Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
It's Mentally Yours from Ellen and Yvette. Focus on your mental health, you surely won't regret. It's mentally yours.
Welcome to Mentally Yours, metro.co.uk's weekly podcast about all things mental health. I'm Ellen.
And I'm Yvette. And today we're chatting to Sally and Henry Mabry. Sally's son and Henry's brother, Tom, died following a struggle with alcoholism. We're going to be talking to them about that and Alcohol Awareness Week.
I mean, Alcohol Awareness Week, it is what it says, basically. It is to make people aware of alcohol and alcohol misuse.
The UK theme this year is alcohol and relationships. And obviously that's quite, you know, going to mean a lot of things. But for us, obviously, it's our relationship that we have with Tom, my older brother, mum's eldest son. And it's what alcohol did to our relationship and how it really affected it.
Yeah, so I think that's really is what it means to us. And I think that was the reason why we decided that this was also a good time to release the video that we have put together, which we can talk about a bit later. But yes, it's a good cause.
A good cause.
Yeah, we'll come on to the video a bit later, as you said, but would you mind telling us a bit more about why exactly you did want to get involved?
Well, it was really after Tom died. Tom passed away when he was 29, and I'll go back to when he was a little boy. I mean, he was a little boy who was full of naughtiness, I'd say. He was the eldest of four. He's my firstborn. My father and mother's and both sides of the family, that he was actually the first grandchild. A little special, you know. Sorry, Henry. Henry was the youngest one, so, you know, tough. But yes, he was the firstborn, and you know, he was gorgeous. I mean, he was lovely. He had these great big brown eyes, and everybody used to comment on his eyes. They used to sort of say, "Wow, that's going to be a killer for the girls." And he was a lovely boy. I mean, he went through school, and he, you know, came out the other side. You know, he had lots of friends. He loved his sport, and
he was a pretty hands-on guy, wasn't he? Because that's why he went to agricultural college, and he really had a talent with that stuff, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. And we also used to say when he was a little boy, you know, you'd give him the building bricks, and we used to say, Tom can build really good brick walls. We always said, you know, he is a builder of, you know, hands-on doing things. And, you know, and I always used to say he was my little man, because he would just help me with lots of little things and lots of little jobs. And he was just a fantastic little boy, a fantastic young man. And even the drink, you know,
took over
and started to control him. Even then, he was just a fun. We actually say he was a fun drunk. He really was. I mean, he was always a happy man.
Well, that was saying his heart was always in the right place. Whenever you know, something went wrong, and we had you know, a bit of an incident at home, because he just suddenly, it would always, with alcohol, get to that tipping point, doesn't it, where you can be happy and jolly, then you get to that point where then you just fall into that depression, and he would then just become depressed, morose. And when we had incidents like that, and obviously as you know, if most of the time it was actually me and you at home, actually,
because
I was living at home at the time, and it was just heartbreaking seeing like that. And it was just so, he then felt guilty the next day, and it was he was just showed how he was such a kind young man, that he then would wake up the next day and he'd feel guilty, and the garden the next day would just be immaculate. And he would just go out and he would just be like, you know what, I'm gonna do this for you, Mum, because I'm so sorry about last night, and that, you know,
He couldn't say sorry as such, could he?
No, but that was his way of saying sorry. Yeah.
I mean, it was like when you, a story that we actually do say in the video about the wallet.
Yeah. When his addiction really started to take over, obviously, like a lot of people suffering with addiction, they need to feed that addiction. And he, obviously, at this point, in the peak of it, he wasn't working. And so he needed, you know, he was obviously wanted any bit of money that he could get. And I just come back from holiday, and I had some euros that I needed to exchange. And basically, my wallet went missing, and I found it the next day underneath the sofa, and it was open, and the money had gone missing. And I approached him, and like a lot of addicts, he was in denial. And you know, there was obviously a little bit of an argument, and he felt guilty. And I remember at the time my Xbox was like completely broken. It was, there was just something wrong with it. And I came back after a weekend away, and he'd fixed it. And I just remember him looking at me, and it was just that grin that he had.
Yeah,
and he just looked at me
grin.
As I sort of walked in the house on the Sunday evening. He was like, do you want a game of FIFA? And I was like, is it working? I don't think it works. And he was like, it is now. And we just went around, and that just shows the type of guy that he was, you know. And he just, it's so frustrating, because he had so much going for him. And
he did because he was you know, he when he left school, he was, we always said he was a hands-on person, so he decided he really wanted to go into, he was going to go to agricultural college, which he did eventually, but he actually went to agricultural college after school, didn't he? He'd got his lifeguard qualifications, he went to agricultural college. And then from there, he then went and did PGL, which is...
it's like an adventure park.
An adventure park, where parents go and leave their children for holidays. It's a wonderful place when you've got young children. You can just drop them off and leave them there. And Tom was actually there, and he'd be doing all the sports side. And actually, eventually, he was promoted and was working actually over in Paris, which he loved, because he was going to all the Euro Disney things. And it was brilliant. And I think that was when everything was really going well. It was settled, and we thought, you know, wasn't even really thinking about what Tom was doing. I was sort of thinking about, you know, what the rest of the family were doing. And then he was sort of in a relationship, and that sort of broke down, didn't it? And then,
he moved back first, didn't he? He moved back because he thought, actually, I now want to come home, and I feel ready to set up his own little business. And he came back and set up his own little it was like a garden design business, yeah. And he started doing really well, and he was in a happy relationship, and unfortunately, yeah, like you said, that fell through.
Yes, that fell through. And then I think at that stage he became a little bit more depressed.
He was just a little bit heartbroken. He just felt pretty down. And then there was a little bit of an increase in his drinking, but it wasn't like out of the ordinary. It was kind of, you know, just like everyone going to after work for a few pints, you know, trying to forget about what you've been through, forget about the sort of the negativity kind of thing, and, you know, try and, you know, throw yourself in with socializing with friends and, you know, get into that kind of group. And he, unfortunately, then just on one occasion, he drove back from a country pub just around the corner from my mum's, and it's less than a mile away, actually, back to the house. And he, as he was on his way back, he blacked out behind the wheel and rolled the car. Thankfully, did not take anyone else out, but actually this is the introduction of his epilepsy coming back into his life, because he had a little bit of epilepsy when he was about
8 years old. He suddenly started this petit mal epilepsy, and it only lasted, I think, for 2 or 3 years, and he never went into full fits. You know, he sort of grew out of it, but this unfortunately started to creep back in again. I mean, I have to say, the last 4 or 5 years, was it epilepsy? Were they alcohol-induced fits? I don't know. I mean, there's an awful lot that goes with, you know, the alcohol. You can go fit, you go into fits,
yeah, you actually like hallucinate.
And he was hallucinating as well at one stage, you know. Well, but
when the epilepsy came back into his life, that's when his mental health really deteriorated, and he became, you know, obviously he lost his license, and actually when they found his car, they actually did breathalyze him, and he was just over the limit. So so he lost his license, not because of just the epilepsy, but also because of the alcohol, and all of that combined, his mental health, just he just fell into a depression. And it just,
so would you say that the kind of falling into depression, was that triggered by alcohol use, or do you think it's kind of the other way around, or is it a mix of both? What happened after that? When did it start becoming that he had an alcohol problem?
I think really personally, obviously it's really difficult to, you know, when someone's, you know, 19, 20, to know whether they were drinking too much anyway. Because obviously I suppose my mum wasn't able to watch him 24/7 and kind of thing. But I personally, as someone and mum seeing all this happen, it really was the depression first, his mental health deteriorating, and then the alcohol followed. He used the alcohol as a coping mechanism to pick himself up, to make himself feel better. And unfortunately, then it just, took over his life.
It did just begin to spiral, didn't it, really? Yeah. It was just, I mean, you know, whereas he would, after work, you know, he'd go for perhaps a couple of drinks and then come back home and have supper, and then he'd go into work. Then he would, it would then become not just a couple of drinks. It would then, he'd come home and then he'd perhaps have more to drink at home. I think that's probably when I picked up a bit. I thought, you know, he's gone to the pub and now he's coming back and he's drinking a bit more. Then the weekends, it was then going into the pub, the local pub, and when he couldn't drive, he would then just get a taxi and he would go into town and he would drink in town and come back in a taxi. And I can remember when we were getting towards the time that he could renew his license, and I was saying, you know, this is great, you know, you can get back to working, getting a lot more work and get your license back. And he just said, oh, I don't need a license, I don't need that at all, no, I'll be fine. And I just think he just thought, no, if I get my driving license back, I won't be able to drink. I mean, God forbid he got his license back and he did drink, you know, sort of over the limit and everything, God forbid. But that never happened. And I think, and that then was where it began to spiral.
Mm. It's so difficult, isn't it, as well? Because especially I think there's something about British culture. We really normalise drinking lots and lots of alcohol, men and women, but I would say possibly more towards men, you know, just the quantities that we think it's normal to drink. And we do have this culture of, you know, after a difficult day at work or, you know, something difficult happening in our personal lives, you know, it's seen as totally normal, really, isn't it, to blow off steam and just head down the pub and drink lots.
Well, I mean, also the other thing is you can do that, you know, I mean, whereas you can, you know, alcohol isn't illegal. I'm not saying that they should make it illegal. You know, drugs are obviously illegal. So alcohol, it's available. It's accessible. Mm. It's available.
And that's what's been our, to be honest, when we've been going around schools and we've been doing public speaking and sharing our story, that's also what's been great about how we've engaged with students, because we're not going in and saying, because obviously doing this kind of work, you know, people, like you said, because alcohol is such a big part of the culture, people will judge, you know, and think, oh, well, they're going around, I bet they're saying to the kids and stuff, don't drink. Trust me, I've been into schools where I've been setting up and I've heard sick formers come in and they've been like, oh god, this is an alcohol awareness talk, oh god, I bet they're going to be saying don't drink, you know, kind of thing. And the amazing, I think for us, we do drink.
Yeah, we actually, you know, tell them that, don't we?
You know,
we just
I went to university. I you know, I had a great time. You know, you're right, it is a big part of the culture. But seeing what my brother went through, I'm obviously aware of like how it can so easily just take over your life. So I have always gone in the back of my head, you know, kind of, you know, it's so, you know, sensible to have, you know, those breaks and, you know, not get in that trap of drinking regularly, because it's, you know, can so easily, you know, if you're not just using it as a coping mechanism, it can go on the other sort of way. It can just become part of a routine and you can suddenly find that you're drinking a lot of the time or all the time. So,
but I think it's also, as you say, that if something's gone wrong in your life, it's the thing that you suddenly think, I must have a drink. I must have a drink just to relax, to make myself, you think, make yourself feel good. But of course, when you've had so many, you then suddenly become quite.
You can, yeah.
Yeah, you can become, you can become depressed and tearful. And so it's the other way, emotional and everything. You know, I mean, I can remember actually, you know, Tom died. And I remember he was in hospital and I think he was in hospital, you know, we can never remember how long. We seem to think, we always say we think it's about 6 weeks, but you know, I don't think it was that long actually. It seemed like a very long time. Yeah. But I had to go and tell my father, who was just up the road in a nursing home, and he was in his 90s, and I could not actually say that he was in, because he'd got, his organs were failing. And I actually went to Dad and I said, oh, Dad, you know, Tom's, he's not too good at the moment. I think that's the first thing I said, he's not too good at the moment. Then he died and Dad did not know quite how bad he was. And I had to then go in and I said, Dad, I have to tell you that Tom actually had a really violent fit, came into hospital and hasn't come out, and he's died. I couldn't put him through the pain of having to, or those 3 or 4 weeks that we had, just thinking, oh, what's going to go on? You know, I mean, he was a very strong man, my dad, but I'm not saying it killed him, but then, you know, Tom died in February. My father died Christmas of that year. And that time between Tom going and grandpa or dad going was horrible. Absolutely horrible. So I can understand why people are, you know, can sort of, with times like that, sort of think, I'm going to have a drink to relax. You know, it's so easy. And I'd completely forgotten what you asked me.
Oh, well, no, I was asking if you were able to talk to him about your concerns, really.
Yes. And we did try to talk to him, you know, because then I would sort of say, you know, you really are drinking too much, and he would just, no, I'm fine, and he just wouldn't, he wouldn't admit to it, he wouldn't accept it at all. And it really wasn't until the last couple of 24 months before he died that then he started to ask for help. And he was actually saying, you know, please, can you help me? And I think that was at the stage when he was having the fits. He was actually having back-to-back fits. He would have a fit, and I could manage these at home.
And it wasn't epilepsy anymore. These were alcohol fits. It was really...
But lucky for him, he knew when they were coming, and he'd sort of say, oh, I can see flashing lights. So I'd get him on the ground or on the sofa, and I'd put my knee into his back so that he wouldn't roll over, get him through the fit. But then he would have another one. And then, you know, if I could manage it, I would. But then I'd probably have to call the ambulance. But and it was times like that that then he'd say, can you help me? And I can remember actually, on one occasion, I actually took him upstairs and got him into bed, and he actually said, "Oh, don't go, Mum." And I actually got I've got a duvet or something and put it on the floor and slept beside him because he was so scared. And I can remember that night he actually said to me, "Mum," he said, "will you be with me when I die?" And I thought, shit, you know, that's a real. And because I was saying, oh, don't be stupid, Tom, you're going to die before that. I'm going to die before you. You know, that's ridiculous. So
reassuring him, weren't you?
It was just reassuring him. At that stage, I did not think that he was going to die. I think I hoped that he was going to beat it with all our help.
How were you both coping at this point? Because that sounds incredibly difficult.
It was really, really hard. I mean, I was at school, and it was funny when my it's not funny actually, but when my friends came to the funeral, the first thing they said to me after the funeral, one of my best friends came up to me and just sort of gave me a hug and just said, "Mate, why didn't you tell us you were going through this?" And it's such a school's brutal. I mean, it is when you think about, you know, opening up about things, you're really scared to do that because you're worried that you might become a target. And I kept it all locked up, and I massively regret that. Obviously, I wish I'd spoke to someone.
We encourage people in schools, don't we, students in schools, that they
massively encourage them. And I say, like, I regret that I didn't, you know, open up to anyone, because I found it really, really hard, because I was going from school and then, you know, coming back home, and for a few years he was, you know, living at home. So then I was coming back and seeing, you know, Tom in this way and having to deal, you know, with his struggles, and it was really hard. I found it really tough seeing, you know, my older brother, who, to be honest with you, when you're at school, he's the person you idolize the most. You know, you look at him and you think, oh, wow, you know, he was all right at football. I was sat there thinking, oh, God, he's good at football. And he's doing really well, especially when I was, you know, really young at school, and he was suddenly going out to Paris and working, for PGL and got promotions. I was sitting there thinking, wow, I really want to be like him. He is doing so well for himself. So when it kind of flipped and went the other way, I was just, I was devastated. But yeah, what about you, Mum? Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, I think a bit like you, I think back on who did I tell? I told my brother. I spoke to my brother a lot about it, but really I didn't open up to, girlfriends, and until one day I was just I'd just been playing tennis actually, and just come off, and we were having a cup of coffee all together, four ladies, and you know, the conversation, oh, you know, how's little Jimmy doing, or how's little Camilla doing, or how's little Janie doing, oh, fantastic, all at school, this, that and the other, and blah 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 blah. And I just then went, they sort of said, oh, Sally, how are your lot? And I sort of said, Tom's an alcoholic. And I literally came out with it, and the shock and the horror on some of the faces, I don't think they really knew what to say. And I think one of the ladies I actually did, who was a friend, sort of knew there was bits going on, but not to the extent that it was. Then I sort of managed to sort of start talking about it a bit more, you know, and that And I think that actually did help. And also it introduced it to people who then sort of said, I had another girlfriend who then came to me after I'd been, you know, the couple of years on and Tom was still alive. And she said, my daughter's got mental health issues. And she said, I don't know who to talk. I can't talk about it. You know, can you imagine what everybody's going to think about? Thought I'd talk to you about it. So there's a real taboo about this. And I think that's why we now talk about it, because it's so important not to just sort of
just put it under the carpet and pretend it never happened. I think that is the worst. I don't know about mum, but I want to keep my brother's memory alive and show people that alcoholism, addiction can happen to anyone. It really can. You know, it doesn't matter what, you know, background you come from or anything. It can literally just choose to take over anyone's life.
And it's not just them. It's also, as we say, because we're saying it's the relationships, it's those people around them as well. It's the family, it's the boyfriends, the girlfriends, the grandparents, the uncles, aunts. It affects
everyone who's living in the environment of addiction.
Yes.
This is a tricky question, but did you ever feel any kind of anger towards Tom or like frustration? Because I know that's kind of an experience a lot of people who are in relationships with people who are struggling with addiction. They're just kind of like, why can't you stop? Why can't you just, you know, get over this, move past it? Did you ever feel like that?
Massively. I was honestly, like I said to you before, because I was looking at him, thinking him as a role model, and I saw him with so much potential, I was so angry and frustrated, because I sat there thinking, mate, come on, snap out of this. You have so much going for you. But unfortunately, after work that we've been doing, I've really understand now of addiction that there's just so much more to it. It's not just someone picking up a bottle and just drinking. You know, he, bless him, was obviously just, I suppose, you know, a bit vulnerable, and he fell into that depression. His mental health deteriorated, and then unfortunately he just used alcohol to, you know, to put it, you know, to make himself feel better.
And we did go to rehab, didn't we, at one stage, that we had a sort of what I call a family fun day, which is probably not what they call it, but we went along for this family fun day. And it was just sort of a day of telling us how to work with an alcoholic and how to perhaps help them. And it was that
it was just giving us advice, really, yes, wasn't it? How to try and
tough love, a bit of tough love. And so that was probably the anger as well, because I found that really difficult, because you wanted to give tough love, you wanted to say, you know, don't do that, and then not talk to them, and then go away and hope they get a bit of a wake up call. I didn't last very long, I have to say, because as a mum, I wanted to go and check up on him and check he was all right. But there was anger as well, but as we got further in, I suppose eventually I thought, he's not, you know, he's not going to make it. He's just not going to make it.
Tell us more about the video that you've now created, and also that your work in schools, because as you said, sounds like you've done some fantastic work, kind of raising awareness and keeping his memory alive. But have you found that work difficult? To sort of go over the story again, or have you learned some useful things? And yeah, tell us more about Wish You Could Have Stayed.
Well, so yeah, I mean, it's been so rewarding going around all these schools. I mean, we've been around, oh God, how many schools?
Well, I mean, schools, rehabs and prisons, we've probably gone over about 1,000, I would think. Yeah. You know, it's been...
And it has been really, really hard. But one thing, you know, we've picked up on is the messages that we've received from all these young people who have said, thank you so much for helping us. You know, thank you so... And, you know,
we can only act
as a signpost and, you know, point them in the right direction. But what's really sort of helped them is the amount of kids that have come up to us and actually opened up about their story that teachers never knew about. And then the teachers have been able to signpost them and take them to the school nurse or whatever and get them that help that they need. And for us, that is, I mean, I don't think there's any you know, better feeling that's sort of, you know, that we've got out of our work, really, is there? I mean, from that, I mean, and then the video, it's been, yeah, I mean, we started when COVID struck, we kind of sat there and thought our work got hit massively because obviously not being able to go into schools, going to prisons, going to rehabs, it just wasn't possible. And even now, you know, schools are pretty hesitant with it, having, you know, outsiders come in. And
we were actually, we were nearly stuck because we were actually at a school doing a week in Great Yarmouth at schools. And we could see the country slowly closing down. And the one college sort of said, oh, we've only got sort of, you know, 25 capacity of kit students here. We'd already done two schools, I think. Mm-hmm. And we thought we've got to get out and we've got to get back home. That's
kind of when we kind of then came back. We obviously did the first lockdown. And then about 2 weeks into the lockdown, I kind of sat there and I thought, Mum, I've always wanted to turn our story into a video so we can get Tom's memory, our story, out to more schools, because we can't, you know, we can't go all the way up to, you know, the edge of Scotland, you know, and then stuff like that. It's just too far. And we just sat there and thought, I'd love to be able to reach more people. And we basically sat there and started researching film companies. Typical me, I started off sort of very ambitiously going towards some of the really big film companies, and obviously some said no. And one of the big companies was Casual Films, and they turned around and said yes. And I was just, I couldn't believe it. We went away, we had a quote from them, we went away, we then had to really dig deep and go and fill in lots of forms to raise money and get grants and stuff, which I have to tell you, doing forms, doing grants is probably the most boring thing I've ever done in my life. But it
was particularly when you do one and it takes you about nearly took us 3 weeks, and we said, I've got to get it in, deadline. And then we said, phew, we've got it in. And they said, you know, we will reply within however many weeks. Anyway, they came back quite quickly, actually, and said,
with about two lines. So I was saying no. And it was like, oh God. And then over a few months, we eventually raised about £13,000. We had such generous donations from Lady Edwina Grosvenor, who's the sister of the Duke of Westminster. We had a lot of local support from Shropshire.
We had the round table,
a lot of local organizations that just threw some money into us, and eventually we hit our target. And then they put together a great sort of little just guidance script, which sort of said, right, we're going to go ask you these questions. So we were just a little bit aware what they're going to ask us. And the documentary's come together, and it's only around, because we didn't want it, because it's obviously going into schools, we didn't want it too long. So it's only about half an hour long. And the whole thing is just going to be pushed out. The trailer is currently on YouTube, and the full version is on the website. And we're just hoping, what we're really hoping, it is for free, but we're just really hoping that schools will just do a bit of a fundraising event for our charity, which is called the Lost Days Charitable Trust. And that we can, our big aim is to hopefully one day sponsor an addict and try and do something we were never able to do with Tom. And just try and get someone into a rehab and try and get them on that road to recovery, because that would just be, be amazing for us.
It would be wonderful.
What's the kind of message that you're trying to send throughout your talks and this Alcohol Awareness Week? Because I know earlier you said you're not necessarily saying, like, we're here to ban alcohol entirely. What is the message that you'd like to send?
For me, like, when I was at school and I was going through all of this, I felt really lonely because I didn't speak to anyone about it. And I just want all the young people there to realize that there is help out there, that they can go and talk to people. I mean, the amount of messages that we've received through, like, you know, Instagram or mum with email and stuff like that from young people has been amazing, really, hearing their stories and just trying to help them. But yeah, we just want to sort of help them, make them realize that there's charities out there such as obviously ourselves that can, you know, help you and speak to you and signpost you in the right direction. There are also charities like NACOA, which is a helpline for young people to call up so they can have a bit of, you know, guidance if they're living in the environment of addiction. There's also ones like Adaction, Aquarius. You know, if there's people, you know, when we go into rehabs as well, we're trying to encourage them to, you know, keep on that road of recovery. We want them to stay clean. So with that, we're saying, look, you know, please stay in rehab. Or when we go to other places to talk and there may be people struggling, we're saying, please go to rehab, please go to AA, please go to your local GP if you are struggling. And there are anyone also who may be listening, if you are living in a family environment where someone is struggling with an addiction, just remember what we said. We also went to a rehab and they provided support for families. You can go to a family day out and go and talk to people and get that advice. And I think, without saying the cliche, we want people to realize that, you know, they're not alone. That, you know, we are just trying to, yeah, make people just realize that and try and get that help and not be afraid to get that help.
Goodbye from mentally yours. So go away, enjoy your day, get on with all your chores from mentally yours.
If you've been affected by any of the issues we've discussed today, you can give the Samaritans and Ring on 116 123.
If you like Mentally Yours, you can also find us on Twitter. We're at MentallyYRS. We also have a lovely Facebook group, which is just called Mentally Yours.
And if you really liked us, you could do us a massive favour and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It's much appreciated. Helps us, you know, continue doing what we're doing. So please do rate and review and check back in next week for more Mentally Yours.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.